Monday, February 22nd. Is that a real date? February 22nd. Yes, it is. And that is today. And it's LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier here with Hayes Davenport and Alyssa Walker. We have a, this is a great show. We've got Cerise Castle, a freelance journalist, here to talk about KCRW's new programming for Black content creators, which they maybe have one or two of left. That is a fantastic interview. Please stick around for it. She was wonderful to talk to. We've got a little bit of housekeeping to do before we get into a very full, frankly, agenda. We have up for everybody, not just our Sepulveda pass holders, our TMZ 30 Mile Zone episode, Ingrid Goes West. I feel like I'm alone in this room. I haven't heard a single sound out of either of my two
we're
co-hosts.
Just so you're doing such a good even job. We have nothing to add.
Even we're just ripping through.
I know. We're like, wow.
Even when I said their names,
I'm ready.
At some point, into an abyss.
All I have is that I want to talk about the weather in 1 second, but I'm just waiting until you're done.
Okay. Well, let me
I feel like that's what Hayes
finish my tidying up.
Bring it back to.
I like doing a little weather check, a local show.
It's fine.
Ingrid Goes West. This is a great TMZ episode. If you have not had the opportunity to listen to any of our Sepulveda Pass episodes, this is a great one to get started on. It is our Patreon subscription where you can get all this extra content for.
But
just,
it's free. This one is actually, you don't even have to subscribe. It's
you don't have to subscribe. This is a teaser. You get access to it, and then you are going to be hooked and jonesing for more. That is our plan.
You have to share it on social media though, as befitting the movie.
Next,
you have to share it with all of your followers.
Next week, we have a new episode of The 10 with Samantha Elu Hernandez. And she and JT, the LA storyteller, they have a very exciting project on East Hollywood gentrification that we wanted to definitely plug. That is at easthollywood.eventbrite.com. You can RSVP 3 separate nights in March. You have the opportunity to hear 2 very smart, very witty thinkers about Los Angeles.
I did since you want people to just jump in. I did a live stream last night on
my
Saturday night with just dipping my toe in it. It was so fun.
Yeah.
And JT appeared in the chat and then he came on the stream and talked about the Hollywood Community Plan and redlining in East Hollywood and CD13 generally. He showed us the pamphlets that they have made up.
Oh my God, they're amazing. They're beautiful.
Thai and Armenian and Tagalog, and they have signs that they've like put up on Virgil and Hoover and other places around the district. And he just like, I wish anyone listening who wasn't there, I wish you had been there, because then you could have heard just like it was just so compelling talking about this. But you can go. Actually, I'm glad you weren't there, because now you can just go to easthollywood.eventbrite.com.
And also you can watch Instagram
it?
Live.
Deleted.
Oh, you had to be there. You had to be there.
You have to be there. That is actually going to be my new policy.
I didn't even know you were
going
to do that. So next time I would have.
I posted on our Twitter account, so you should follow.
I don't sit on Twitter all day and just look to see what Hayes is doing.
It was our shared account. But wait, no, there was something. Oh, it was because my phone died. It doesn't save them automatically, which I appreciate, actually, to be honest. And it was in the middle of JT, I think, plugging his Twitter account. So I'll plug it for him right now. It's at Jimbo_times. Go ahead.
Last item that we have for our Sepulveda pass holders. For TMZ, we've got a new poll up this morning. And it is, we always try and do a theme. This time it is movies that lost previous polls. It is the runners up from our last 4 polls. Those were
Trying Again,
Dope, The Big Sleep, Decline of Western Civilization, and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. If you are a member or if you want to join, you get to vote. And
Anyone have a horse in that? Do we want to tip the scales?
I would love to watch The Big Sleep again, but I have a feeling that Dope is going to win, which I'm not
interesting.
Mad at. I'm not mad at that.
Since you mentioned too, I love Decline of Western Civilization.
Okay.
Have either of you seen it?
No.
Was there a second? You said since I mentioned two.
You mentioned Dope and Big Sleep.
Yeah, but you only mentioned one.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just like, you know, I'm just like, I'm evening out the scale.
No, I have not seen it. It's about the punk scene, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I would be happy to watch any of these.
Depending on which one you watch, we'll eventually get to two. This is number one. Mm-hmm. But number two is The Metal Years. So we'll get to them all eventually.
Okay.
Yeah.
I put my faith in the voters to make the best decision. And let's get into the weather, right?
The weather, great.
That's throw
to,
yes.
Let's go to Hayes Davenport for the weather. I tried to commiserate with the two of you about this and didn't get quite the result I was looking for. It is so, I don't know if it's the weather or not, but I'm walking around very staticky. It is, the humidity is very low. I think the
I
wind.
I didn't know what you were talking about. The wind makes
it. Yeah, he thought you meant like you're.
Yes,
you're feeling
powerful. I'm not
going to
betray what. Yes, what you. But yes, it was very funny. The misunderstanding.
Hayes said, "I feel like I'm giving off a lot of electricity,
yeah, like
literally,
good vibes.
And you just giving off electricity
like
all day
yeah.
long." And I said,
and
"Literally."
Like an aura.
I said,
"And when you said literally, I thought you meant figuratively literally." which is what I'm more accustomed.
But he really
to
just
hearing,
wanted
frankly.
To talk about the dew point. Which I think has been
honestly,
really low. And the wind probably creates more static
in my head,
energy,
the wind
right?
is like generating static.
Yeah,
that's my theory. I don't know anything about this. Okay.
This weather sucks. I think if that is what you wanted commiseration on, I'm happy. To give
you can
it to
hear
you.
Me coming. If I like take off my t-shirt tonight, it sounds like Rice Krispies. It's so scary. I'm worried that I'm like sick.
Well, you can get a humidifier for your room.
Is that gonna be like? Maybe. Is that gonna be like our version of all of the catastrophes that happened in Texas?
Yes.
Like we're gonna have a statewide St. Elmo's fire.
Like, did you see like that? What there
was
like
just electricity everywhere.
There was a warning that went out that was telling us to conserve electricity because we might need to give it
that.
To Texas, which I don't even think we
great.
Can. I don't think there were physically able. There's part of the grid. That it, mm-hmm. you know, is not the Texas grid that is, you know, on other grids. Yeah, but I just thought that was like such an interesting, like unplug your toaster, California, for Texas. And I was like, what? Like, is
that don't mess
really?
With Texas,
is that really
as
going
the,
to help?
The LA Times editorial board yeah. said.
Don't
I was
mess
like
with Texas.
Finding myself... Like, don't mess with Texas. Don't gloat,
don't
about,
gloat
Texas.
About Texas.
I, first
yeah.
of all, I mean, I won't gloat about Texas because it's real people who are freezing to death. But at the same time, I was kind of hoping that the state of Texas would do what they normally do and sue the LA Times editorial board for infringing on their copyright of that phrase. We have so much.
The problem is very different here because we have acknowledged that there is a problem. So I do think it's a little bit different.
Right. Yeah, it's the first step, admitting that yeah. you need help. We have a lot of news to get into. First of all, Hayes, what is going on with COVID vaccinations? We have a little bit more data now than we have previously, right?
I mean, globally, it looks like vaccinations stop transmission, according to at least for the Pfizer vaccine. So that could be contributing to the decline in cases. We also had Soumya Karlamangla put out another in a series of like there are hundreds of great articles about COVID. She talked to some doctors who study this stuff who basically said like, yeah, the reason that cases are continuing to decline, deaths are slowly declining, hospitalizations are declining pretty fast is, you know, because of what one thing we've theorized, which is that so many people got infected.
Right.
And, you know, that has led to just like natural immunity, natural declines, especially in vulnerable communities where so many people got infected kind of all at once during the fall surge. We got in this last week a little bit, but I don't want to make it seem like it was good policy to open things up when they did. Mm-hmm. Because basically the reason that it's literally human sacrifice. I'm using literally again as it's meant to be used. It's like that is how we got to this. Yes, it is. Like the policy led. Scott rolled his eyes. But
I didn't roll my eyes. I was thinking.
He looked questioning.
But I was thinking.
The policy avenues we pursued that led us to this decline is the result of human sacrifice. It's because like so many people literally got COVID and died, many of them, that now we're out of this surge. Like that is what got us here more than policy decisions. So yep. it's just like, it's tough to celebrate this huge decline in case and like comparative safety because of the actual sacrifice that that led us here.
Actual good news is kind of scarce right now. But
sure.
I do think that we have, I think we've caught a couple of lucky breaks. In particular, what seems to be the case, as you mentioned just a moment ago, Hayes, is that the vaccinations are really helping reduce the likelihood that the virus will transmit throughout a community. That's huge. That by no means was necessarily going to be the case, and also was something that was in doubt for quite a long period of time. That's a huge lucky break. That's definitely reason to be optimistic going forward. Also, it seems like, again, we're dealing with a new virus, brand new virus that humans have never had in history before. So we don't know how exactly it's going to behave. It does seem like it is less likely that people are getting reinfected, people who have already had it before. That takes them out of the transmission pool and again gives you some hope that maybe we will see a lasting decline in the number of new cases. Those are both huge breaks. If that mm-hmm. actually stays and remains the case, that I think dramatically changes the prospects for all of us for the remainder of the pandemic, because it does mean then in that case that continued vaccinations and increasing rate of vaccination will really help us bring to a close this chapter in all of our lives.
Meanwhile, this is also something that we've talked about more speculatively, but this is borne out by data now. We have vaccination rates by neighborhood and by smaller cities in Los Angeles. And at the top of the list is Bradbury with 90% vaccination. Bradbury is a very, very small community. And
it is a city. If you were wondering.
It's also a community. It's a city. Yes. That's why.
I'm just saying it should not be a city.
Yeah.
But it just happens to be a city.
Number two is industry, which is also the very tiny place that should not be a city. And then the rest in the top 10 are some of the richest neighborhoods and cities in LA County. You have Cheviot Hills. You have Beverly Hills. You have Bel Air, Beverly Crest. There's a very direct correlation between wealth, disproportionate whiteness in these places, and people getting the vaccines much more quickly. I don't think anyone is surprised after all the articles we've read to this effect, but I think it's good that they're putting this, that they're gathering this data and putting it out there. But it tells a similar story, I think, to what we've talked about before.
Let's move on to schools. I honestly, after we recorded last week, I thought that this would be something that we would spend a lot more time on. But basically, the events of the week have been such that we've just got so much to cover. Schools are now sort of, kind of, given the green light to reopen. Alyssa has been periodically turning into Lewis Black from the Pixar movie Inside Out, where she just lights on fire. But Alyssa, what is the state of schools?
I can't even
County?
Remember what the a week ago. Like, yeah, I guess we were unsure. Right. Who knows? Time is. We were unsure about what the reaction was going to be from the three Spider-Men pointing at each other in the. It's like, the school board, the teacher. But the school board and the teachers are now on the same side. They stand, they're the two Spider-Men on this side. But so we had one of these once again where our county supervisors can just control what happens in the county now, I guess by tweeting. So they did
so
this
weird.
With outdoor dining, and now they're going to do it again with schools. And Supervisor Hahn just dropped this tweet. It was just like, this week we're going to move into the tier where we expect to move into the tier where schools will be allowed to open, and they will be open as soon as this week. It's just like the outdoor.
She tweeted Sunday night schools can reopen tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Well, it wasn't,
if they,
we didn't,
they said no, and they even said they'll probably be able to reopen it was, tomorrow.
It was that we,
and which was President's Day.
First of all, none of us were going to school that day. But it was the models looked like the tier was going to change. We were going to enter the new tier on Tuesday. We did, but no schools magically reopened. I mean, some schools might have that already had plans too, but
because I think even like
it wasn't like the doors were thrown open by Friday.
Because I think even the county said that like it makes us eligible to reopen, and schools do have to submit
a waiver.
They said no waiver anymore. That was the thing.
Okay, no waiver, but you did have to have a COVID safety.
Yes, you did have to have a plan. Yeah, so no more of submitting of the waivers.
To apply.
Right.
So if you already had a COVID safety plan in, I mean, but look, this was so weird, and the fact that as you mentioned, Alyssa, that the Board of Supervisors keeps doing this seems suspicious. It's a 5-person body. So I guess I'm just a little bit suspicious anytime one of them takes to Twitter and is like, this is happening tomorrow. It's kind of like, don't you have to consult with at least 2 other people in violation of the Brown Act?
Two of them did tweet the same thing. Two of the supervisors.
Janice Hahn, I mean, for her part, Supervisor Hahn went on Fox, who are currently ginning up, and they have their hands in many pies right now throughout LA County, one of which is encouraging LAUSD parents to boycott remote learning. Janice Hahn went on a show with Alex Michelson of Fox News and panel co-host Dr. Drew and talked about her decision to tweet that, and was basically just like, I was just so excited seeing that the model said that we were ready to reopen that I just figured, why wait? I'll just tweet it out now. And was kind of surprised at the controversy that caused. I mean,
but also,
like, whoa,
okay, Dr. Drew's kids don't go
tweet.
To LAUSD, first of all, so shut up. But I think like... Nobody who doesn't have kids should be allowed to talk about this at LAUSD. If you do not have children in this situation, just don't even talk about it. But the two things I think, like, first of all, she did throw out a date on another interview, I think on KPCC or something. She said March 1st. And so again, you're putting these ideas out there and just being like, we're getting this done, with not really going by what's being said when you go to the school board and you go to the superintendent and you go to the union, who have all said the same thing. They've been saying it for a long time, which is, if you get the teachers from the elementary school, teachers and staff vaccinated, they can go back. Long Beach has done that. They have a date. It's in March. They are ready to go. They did it very easily. They have their own health department. They were able to decide the priority of who got the vaccinations. But you know what? So do we. So if they wanted to have that conversation, it seems like they could have said that as part of their tweeting laws that they are doing, tweeting policies. It's just like, they could also make it so.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's worth noting that while the Board of Supervisors has allowed for school districts to reopen, as we're mentioning, the decisions mostly is being made independently by the school districts. So
yeah, by the superintendent and the school board. Can I brag about our show? I was not doing this intentionally at the time, but you remember Kelly Gonez, board president, came on the show.
That's right.
And I was like, I don't want to put you on the spot, but like, you are saying right now that you can't open because of state restrictions. So everyone insisting that you open is like, you throw it to the state. But the state policy can change really fast. We've seen that happen over and over again, where like suddenly you can reopen. So if that happens, will you stand by that it's actually not safe to reopen right now? And she said yes, and they are doing that. I mean, I'm glad to see that, because in almost every other case, we've seen supervisors who previously said that it wasn't safe to have outdoor dining suddenly being like, let's party.
That's what happens when you put people on the record, Hayes. Way to go. okay, so I just to close out this segment, I do think it's important to note LAUSD is by far the largest, but we have many, many school districts in the county. Some of them have started reopening. This has been a week where anger about the school closures has really boiled over. The governor is trying to stem the tide of public outrage about the closures, even as outlets like Fox News try to make people more mad about it. The governor said he would be setting aside 10% of vaccines for teachers in order to facilitate reopenings. Of course, San Francisco has been having a lot of issues up there as well about anger over the school closures. But the state put out its own dashboard that actually shows you the stages of reopening, whether or not individual school districts are partially in person, fully in person, or fully remote. In Los Angeles County, there are only 4 school districts that are hybrid at all. And those are for the elementary school level only, which I believe is the extent to which the Board of Supervisors has cleared in-person instruction to resume. That is different than other parts of the state. In Ventura County and Orange County, we do see some in-person instruction resuming already. But here we have Las Virgenes and the Malibu area. We have Manhattan Beach School District, Redondo Beach, and the Palos Verdes Unified Peninsula District. So just to give people a sense of what that looks like for Redondo, where, as I mentioned, elementary school is already in a hybrid configuration. They, I believe this past week, started having grades 3 through 5 come back in cohorts. Parents get asked whether or not they're comfortable with their kids participating in in-person learning. And if so, they're assigned a cohort that comes to campus on a specific day. So the goal is having smaller groups of kids physically in person, and then they're not all on campus at the same time. Torrance is going to start doing the same sort of thing soon with cohorts in the morning and in the afternoon, but on the same day. So this seems like something that we will start to see more frequently, especially as we roll into March. And just to give you a sense of what that will, I think, inevitably sort of look like. What else is going on? Garcetti, the mayor, did a COVID show, and I'm with, I think, the 2 biggest fans of the COVID show that live. What happened?
No, I'm sorry. I cannot even touch Alyssa on this. Alyssa is a complete... I have my episodes that I am passionate about, but this is Alyssa's territory.
This one was a real head scratcher for me. Do we have the clip to play the clip?
We do.
All right.
Scott, would you mind sharing your audio with me? You're so generous. I know you will.
Yeah, I can do
so
that.
So just to give
actually, you're just giving me host privileges, and I will share my audio with you. So it's a mutual exchange.
To give a quick update on, I think we talked about this a few times, but the FEMA initiative that will allow 100% reimbursement of hotel rooms for people who are in need of shelter because of the pandemic was announced a month ago by now, right? It was quite a while ago. And Councilmembers Rahman and Bonin, I love it. It's like a cool band. Mm-hmm. It's like a dad rock band or something. But they introduced a motion that would just really say we should do this really fast, and recommended commandeering hotels to do it fast, because if you use your commandeering power, which the mayor does have right now, which we've known he's had for almost a year, but the city attorney recently confirmed that he does indeed have that power, but every lawyer will tell you that he's had it for some time.
Right.
But the point of that would be that it could happen faster, but also you wouldn't have to offer the full value amount to the hotel. I think the wording is you can offer a fair amount and then eventually work out the deal later about how you actually pay for the rooms. But it doesn't really matter because it would be 100% reimbursed by FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no limit, I don't think.
That sounds like a bargain, right?
Let's do it.
Sounds like something that would really light a fire under your ass if you at all wanted this to happen.
So at the COVID show, Claudia Peschuta asked the mayor what he thought about that, what he thought about commandeering. And here's what he said.
On commandeering hotels. Absolutely. I welcome that power. We need money. It's not whether we have the legal ability to. Right now, we're enrolling more and more hotels. That's not the problem. Buying a hotel, there's no FEMA funding source for that. We can pay for rooms right now. We could commandeer extra rooms. Hotels are actually at about 50% capacity right now, which is higher than, I was surprised when I heard that number today. So there's not as many hotel rooms as people would expect. But I think, as I've always said, the sky should be the limit. And I'd make that appeal again to any hotels and motels with extra rooms. Please let us know. So far, I think the number I got today was just in the last few days, we've been able to place a number like 90 more people. The majority of those were women from Skid Row. We're about, I think, to land, hopefully knock on wood, another 200 rooms in another hotel. And that's on top of about 2,000 rooms, which we're replenishing, and 300 rooms in those that were empty and we're filling. So right now we've got as much supply as people from the street right now are asking for in terms of capacity, but I hope every week we continue that. And my message to the Biden administration is don't end this, and don't end this at the end of the pandemic. Help us make sure we get people into these hotel and motel rooms, into transitional and permanent housing as well. So I'm never going to put a number on the top end. If there are hotels that we can get more rooms from, we will continue to add those and be able to pay 100%. So I welcome the legal power. I've known that we've had that legal power. I can not just commandeer, I can claim any properties to do those sorts of things, but you do have to pay for it. So we have to make sure that it meets the letter of the law of a funding source. And luckily, the FEMA one allows us to do that with any hotel rooms that become available, and we're never going to stop pushing hard on those.
All right, so
there's no place. There's no place to stop.
You heard? Because you, well, yeah, I was like, wait, was now here's another sentence. Good point. No, so he actually says it straight up. I can do this. I can take other properties that aren't hotels if I need to. I mean, we're laying it all out here. It is possible. We need money is not really, doesn't seem like that is the barrier here. Although if we might need to pay for it sometime, you know, I'm sure we could free up some money, whatever. But okay. But then the other whole part of this answer is this math, the flurry of math that flies out here. There were more rooms that the city had a couple months ago in September, mm-hmm. I think were the most, over 4,000 rooms. We have about half that right now. So trying to say that we actually are getting rooms all the time and we have no problem getting rooms, but also hotel operators, let me know if you have rooms. That doesn't line up with commandeering. And then now the hotels are at 50% occupancy because there's people coming here for like spring break and like business travelers are, oof, you know, resuming their activity. So now we have fewer rooms. We've acknowledged the power of commandeering. Before he said, months ago, he said he didn't need to commandeer because there were so many offers of people to give their hotel rooms.
Right. He said he didn't want, it was weird because he said he didn't, basically like he didn't want it to come to that because he felt like there were so many hotels and hotel owners that were looking for a way to show their LA spirit and help out. When that proved not to be the case, though, he didn't start commandeering. And now he's saying there's not a question of having the power, but it does seem like he's rejecting pretty categorically any option of doing that, actually taking that step within the time frame established by the federal government.
And then the third point is that he makes is that we have given rooms to everybody who wants them, and we gave 90 women rooms last week. Okay, first of all, anybody who was following LA Can on Twitter saw last week the results of that, a huge miscommunication about how many rooms would be available to the Black women on Skid Row that they offered that program to only after that Judge Carter hearing was that even made available or announced. And there was a huge miscommunication about how many people were allowed to come in and how that was going to be handled. So that doesn't...
Wait, I didn't even hear about that. What was the miscommunication?
That they were told, they were given this amount of information and told that a number of women could come to stay at a hotel, and when they got there, there was just a big miscommunication about how many rooms who would be able to come inside and why.
Wow.
And then so okay, 200 more rooms. I mean, if you went to any service provider in the city, they would give you a list of over 200 people that they have tried to get into.
Yeah.
Room key.
I mean, the miscommunication sucks. Like that stuff, that does happen in this frantic like system. But right there, what it shows is more people showed up just for that than rooms were available.
Yeah.
And, you know, I agree with both of you that that's like the most important. It's just one. It's like 3 seconds in this 1 minute and 45 second long answer. But it sucks all the urgency out of everything else he's talking about. He's saying we want to add. We don't want to set an upper limit on it. We need more money. Like, don't stop.
Yeah, don't let
like,
this program end. Wow.
Like, yeah, exactly. Great. But then to say we have all the capacity that people even want right now just cuts the, like, just undercuts the whole thing. I mean, like, and this is, like, maybe an unpopular opinion. I get not commandeering first. I think the government seizing property is not popular policy. And I think that is, in general, for good reasons. I think it like it leads to it has been used for much more ill than good over over the years. And so I believe, and actually in the Rahman Bonin motion, they say let's explore the possibility of our the legality of
it.
Let's
get
let's get the word on the city attorney. They weren't saying like we do this first, because I think doing the due diligence of like trying to get as many hotels on board as possible is a good place to start. But to do that, you do need to solicit the money first in order to be able to make those deals. And there's a huge amount of money at the state level. And you know that Garcetti isn't asking for that money privately because he didn't in this press conference. They do it. When they want the state to give them money for something, they ask.
Well, he talked about the
purchase.
Oh,
they definitely make it clear that they're doing it.
He talks
it.
About the purchase of hotels, which is a completely different thing, which is not this. It's
money is coming for the purchase
the
of hotels from the state.
Right, that's
it's
the state.
Also coming in the next stimulus package from the federal government. But
through the
this
state,
is
not straight.
This doesn't have to be connected to any of that. This can just be a loan.
Yeah.
The state can just loan $100 million or something that they will get back at the end of this process with 100% reimbursement.
Right.
So it doesn't really feel like he sounds caught to me where like he's worried about like pushing too hard. You know, he's. But that undercutting is, you know, it's wrong. It's obviously not true. And it sounds like a lack of desire to actually push on this to the extent that the LA Business Council wants. And other groups, LA Business Council put out a press release this week saying, let's go. Let's like absolutely max out on this offer. I'm in the city, in the county, it seems like it's only a small number of electeds who are really pushing on this. And we talk about it going through the city council. I think it's honestly graduated past the need for that speed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Bonin and Rahman motion is a report back. We're past that now. We just need to like get the state money. We already have been doing the program. Let's just do it again.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't need to pass through council the first time. But, like it's got to be the mayor at this point, honestly.
Wait, I mean, we've really already seen to your earlier point about like laying the groundwork for doing these sorts of seizures. First, Seize the Hotels was trending this past week on Twitter as activists called for city council to really push ahead with this. But we've already laid the groundwork in terms of having this Project Roomkey be an existing program over the course of the past however many months, and seeing the reports coming out about hotels saying, we don't want our brand associated with homeless people living here. The largest brands. Of course, there are smaller hoteliers that allowed this. There are smaller hotels that have been willing to participate. Hayes, you pointed out on Twitter, smaller hotels have been willing to participate in the program and have had difficulty coming online. The larger participants have had ample opportunity and have made it clear that they're not interested. If you want progressive action, we have to turn to the district attorney's office, where George Gascon continues to be stridently moving ahead with his agenda, even as the reactionary forces throughout the county try to marshal a recall effort against him. The latest news on Gascon is that he is requesting that the so-called Brady list of officers who might be potential liabilities if called as state's witnesses in any case from every department, every law enforcement department within operating within LA County be provided to his office. This is a really big deal. We've talked about the Brady list before, mostly in the context of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. This term, Brady List, goes back to a 1960s era Supreme Court ruling in the case Brady versus Maryland that found that the prosecution, the government, is responsible for providing to the defense any evidence that might impact the credibility of their witnesses against private citizens. And that was a civil rights matter. So George Gascon is using what is known as Brady evidence, instances where, in this case, members of law enforcement have been found where there have been sustaining rulings that they have participated in acts of moral turpitude or outright criminality, falsifying evidence, these kinds of things. And this actually goes back quite a ways into Jim McDonald's tenure as the sheriff.
And just quickly about getting that information, historically not having that information has made it more difficult to actually prosecute cases.
Right.
So even from like a criminal justice perspective, if like what often happens is a case goes through, someone is convicted, and then prosecutors find out later that one of the cops involved had like done something that hadn't been revealed in a previous case, and it gets the conviction thrown out. So like this seems like it should be a bipartisan issue on this, right?
Seems like it should be win-win, and it's very much not. And if we look at like what is a Brady list? Why does this list exist? And why is George Gascon having to ask for it at this point in time? The answer is this is sort of the term Brady list comes from a couple of years back, really, when increasing scrutiny began to be paid towards the conduct of officers. There were efforts after Ferguson, for example, to get law enforcement entities to start regularly providing DAs and prosecutors with any information that they had that could be a Brady finding that could lead to one of these convictions being thrown out in court. The St. Louis DA's office back in, 2015, they said that they were trying to get information on this just so that they could not prosecute if they only had evidence from one of these officers. LA Sheriff Jim McDonald at the time tried to get the same information provided from his sheriff's department to DA Jackie Lacey. And the deputies union sued him to stop that because of the privacy laws that are in place protecting law enforcement officers in the state of California. Now, that went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court ruled that absolutely the sheriff was able to provide that information if it was requested of them by the DA. That was in 2019. George Gascon comes into office, and one of the first things that he's found out is that DA Jackie Lacey never made any such request to Alex Villanueva, who had obviously been opposed to the release of that information anyway. So this, just to give you a sense of where we're at right now, what we're looking at is sort of flipping the argument that's been made by opponents to Gascon on its head, that argument being that Gascon doesn't care about the victims of crime. In this case, we're talking very forthrightly about the victims of crime, victims of wrongful convictions, victims of the system, as it were. And so by getting this list of information, which he's trying to do from all of the law enforcement entities within the county, now we can start to eliminate, for example, the testimony of officers from the Metro unit of the LAPD who have falsified information against people standing trial. That is information that the state absolutely should have when it goes into these proceedings. And it will change people's lives. It will prevent people from wrongfully going to prison. This is a really big deal. As far as the recall stuff goes, we don't really have time to get into it today, but I think we have plenty of recalls in the air and we'll try and get into them.
We have a recall special. Recall special.
Recall special.
I recall the recall. Recalling. Okay, sorry.
Before we do, though, what is happening with the LA Times? Hayes.
I have a theory about this. There was a Wall Street Journal story that said that LA Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, is considering selling the newspaper. It basically immediately resulted in the entire Soon-Shiong family saying that that wasn't true and that they're totally committed to the LA Times. And then he was like, now back to working on a COVID vaccine. And it was like, buddy, I... Have you not heard? Like,
and what? And
I
mean, tweets,
I thought he was going to say, like, now back to owning a great newspaper.
And the other thing was that I think several LA Times staffers pointed out on Twitter they were having a lot of fun with their five moments of complete shock and group chats blowing up. But
I don't know about complete shock.
By the way. So the just, you know.
It was just them reaching for their inhalers collectively.
Their union mandated inhalers that they have on them at all times. But saying that the Wall Street Journal never even corrected it is, they're just like, oh, the story stands. So there must be something.
And so here's my theory. And this was kind of alluded to in some of the replies to this post, is that they are actually going to spin off the San Diego Union Tribune. That's what I think is like what led to this story, that they were like exploring like selling the different assets. And Soon-Shiong said, all right, we're totally committed to the LA Times and running it as a great paper. And then this was really sad. A reporter for the Union Tribune responded and saying like, hey, could you please also say that you're gonna hang on to the entire entity, because like some of us down here are actually really worried, because who he's talking about selling, or who the story said he was talking about selling the Union Tribune to, was Alden Global Capital,
right,
which is a private equity firm that guts papers and basically sells them for scraps. And so that's my theory of like where this story kind of came from, and the reason they're not retracting it, and maybe it'll change the whole circumstances of the purchase. Like, I think that New York Times story might have back in 2018 when they wrote that no rich person wants to buy the LA Times, and then I think Soon-Shiong put in a bid for it. Like 2 days later, the deal was announced. So it's like a Schrodinger's cat thing where like it might change what actually happens. But my guess is that's what the plan was, just based on the response.
Okay, well, we want to get into, there was a huge community safety partnership. This is the program that in the wake of the George Floyd protests and everything that happened last summer, city officials really hung their hat on the LAPD's CSP program as a potential future for policing in Los Angeles, most of them having already rejected, broadly speaking, the defund the police, the message of demonstrators. There was a vote on expanding CSP, this had been a long time in the works, into other public housing developments throughout LA. New city council member Nithya Raman from District 4 voted for it and then took the unusual path of actually apologizing for that vote later, a couple days later, over the weekend, after a lot of people online really vilified her for taking that stance. I think we haven't really caught up on Nithya in general in office. She's been in office for, what, two months now. So it seems like a good time, as good a time as any, to talk about how she's doing so far and whether whether this apology, whether the vote is good. I don't know. What did you guys think of this?
She didn't apologize. She said she made a mistake and that she, I don't know. Can you change your vote? I mean, are you not allowed to change it in the, I don't know how that works. I can't speak for her on that.
Like, I kind of don't think that would be her instinct. She wants it to
stand, but it was,
she made that
right.
No, I mean, it's not that she wants the vote to stand, but like she made that decision. And I don't think she's probably, her priority is probably not like trying to erase that decision that she made from the record. Right. Like she's, she did it.
It wasn't just like that she was saying that she was sorry, but she was actually saying it, saying that she made a mistake, which I thought was an important distinction. And I think like something I've never seen happen in local politics. I was just, the other like most major part, I think, of her statement was that you feel as a council member pressure not to vote. This was a yes vote or a no vote? This was a yes vote.
It was a yes vote.
You're not supposed to like deny things that don't happen in your district. And there, it seemed like very clearly like what she was trying to say was that there's a not just a peer pressure thing, but also that maybe some kind of repercussions from certain people who might hold positions of power on that council if you don't do what you are quote unquote supposed to do, which that part worried me. And was good. I'm glad she said that because that part worries me a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to both of you about how I am not really sure how to communicate honestly about this, about her being in office and my like relationship to all this. Nithya is a very dear friend of mine. I knew her from, but only through like work around homelessness first. That's how I met her. I'm wearing the t-shirt of the organization that she started right now, co-founded. But now, like, we're still very good friends. We talk a lot. And I obviously was like very, very involved in the campaign. And it's something I'm still very proud of. And so, like, you know, I don't want to try to mask that fact that I'm not right. approaching this without, a lot of bias. I've invested a lot of my identity into what we did in the campaign. And I know the two of you too have had like to varying degrees, like personal interactions with her more so than we often get to the elected officials that we talk about on the show. For me personally, the last couple weeks have been absolutely crushing. And this is not, and I just want like, not because of Nithya's behavior, just because of like certain aspects of her situation and the reactions and just like, and this is not like for sympathy. This is like my own just like weakness that I'm like confessing to. It has been like really, really, for me, very difficult to see one vote after another just like come down the pipeline that is puts her in a situation where she has reason to fear that she will either lose her supporters or lose her ability to get policies passed. And if you, and I saw a lot of people being like, why would she do, why didn't she just explain like why she did this? Just like peer pressure? And it's like, it's not like, if you followed the campaign at all, she cares really more than anything about getting better policy done in in City Hall. That's what she came there to do. Like, she put out really, really in-depth policy documents.
Right.
And I think, Alyssa, to, like, you know, I'm not, like, telling tales out of school, but, like, her talking about the pressure, there is a red line around other people's districts. There always has been. And part of that is, like, they feel like they know their districts better than someone else who represents a district that is very different from theirs. They say that out loud all the time. You know, they've said it. They've like, none of this is a secret. But I think it's not the result of like overt threats, but feeling like she has made partnerships around some issues that she really, really cares about. Roomkey is an example. Like, she needs partnerships. and there to get that done. And sometimes it feels like you are dangling people's material conditions on one side and your integrity in the other. And I don't, you know, I honestly like carry like some guilt for having encouraged her to run for this job. Yeah. It is a, I'm like, that has been one of the hardest parts because there are no really good choices. And my personal response to what happened in the last couple of weeks was like a lot of anger. Like I, you know, I was like, I just kind of reflexively was like, people are turning on her so quickly. Don't they understand what she's trying to do? What a position she's in. I just got like very defensive and it was not correct.
Right.
And it was honestly, you know, it was Nithya apologizing that, and like, yeah, it was basically, and she didn't say the words, I'm sorry, but, and maybe some people say that she should have, but she said it was a mistake and she'll try to do better in the future. And, you know, I'm just glad that she was able to react to that more gracefully than I didn't get like mad online or anything, but I found myself definitely getting mad like at online, thinking to myself, like, they're going after her out of all the people responsible for this. Like, you know, it went this way because the people who represent the communities where these public housing projects are want this program in their district.
Right.
And, you know, Sarah Suleiman has like reported on this in ways that like that inject some like nuance into it. Like there have been good relationships to come out of this. The biggest concern, I think, for a lot of people correctly, was that the money came out of the Housing Authority of the City LA's services budget. This wasn't redirected within the LAPD budget.
Right.
It came out of public housing services. And that was the reason why it's not something you can vote yes on under any circumstances. And Nithya was
new money for police.
It's new money coming the LAPD for policing coming from public housing services. And people were totally right to be upset about that. And, you know, I do like she didn't make the excuse. I do hope I saw a lot of people saying like, well, because she's taking police money now. That obviously is not happening. She is attempting to balance those relationships. But I think this approach is the correct one. And I actually think there's a pretty good chance that it could end up with positive culture changes at the council. The way it works right now, I also want people to understand, is every council member runs a committee. They're the chair of a committee. And they decide what gets agendized in that committee. And so you upset one other council member and your stuff can get bottled up. Your motions cannot show up in committee. Paul Koretz, Councilmember Paul Koretz, talked about it this week in city council. He said that another council member, I think one that's not on the council anymore, would not agendize anything he put up just because it was him. So he had to get motions put forward under different other council members' names for them to agendize this stuff.
Oh my God.
Like it can get very petty. It can get super fraught. And that's how you end up with an environment where everyone votes unanimously on everything, but still resent each other.
Sure.
Right.
I mean, yeah. It is kind of a funny dynamic when you put it like that.
It's like, it's a really unhealthy dynamic. And I hope this cuts through it in a really positive way. I think she's well qualified to make that change because she's not beholden to special interest groups. She's, I mean, like not focused on a really long-term political career, advancing to like the state or to like the national level. She just wants to do city work. And I think that puts her in a good position to start to make this change. I was grateful she
did that. Mean, I liked this response. I felt like it was very, I don't like using the word humanizing because I don't feel like human beings should have to.
That was my first response, themselves. Honestly. When I saw it, I was like, this is human.
I did feel like it was a very authentic moment for you know, for the type of power building that is being done. There was a lot and a lot of discourse, not just locally, but also nationally on Twitter about
what types of power building should leftists focus on? And a lot of that conversation was centering around Nithya and around this vote. And I think that there are a lot of people on the left who are skeptical with, in many cases, good reason about the prospects of electoralism. So you have a lot of people who are more or less predisposed to think anytime that somebody gets in office, it is going to be like a switch flips and they're no longer the person that they said that they were going to be. I don't really see that in Nithya's case, but I certainly get the concern. Like, I think that it is pretty well beat into leftists at this point to expect and suspect that that is going to be what happens. That being said, I mean, there are certainly multiple, probably many different theories about how one should go about having the kind of power that Nithya now has. As she mentioned in her thread, for the first time, she has this kind of power. How do you go about using that power to effectively change city government? And it's not really, this is the thing. It's not clear what the correct answer is, like, depending on what outcome you're trying to get, because as we talked about a lot in the aftermath of this race, this is new territory for the city of Los Angeles.
And one thing I want to underscore, that, like, I don't know if it came up when we were talking about this, for anyone who doesn't know, this was not a deciding vote. And none of the other votes that people have been critical of, other votes that happened in other people's districts, like, same story, none were deciding votes or even particularly close. This one was unanimous. Mm-hmm. So, like, that is, like, it's the fundamental question. And I think what was, like, a big factor in her original decision to vote yes is, like, if this maintains relationships, it's worth it, because there is no other result.
Right.
There was no stopping this vote from happening. It was still wrong, but, like, this is the, like, it did not make this policy happen. I just want to make clear.
I do think, though, it's worth pointing out, and this is something that is not just an issue locally, but also in terms of national democratic politics. This is something I frequently deal with as a black person in America. Like, you do. So what I would say is, as somebody who, like Nithya, did campaign against this culture of unanimity, against the go along to get along, or, I mean, in her case, more specifically, the voting yes on something in somebody else's district in order to preserve the opportunity to pass more substantial reforms down the road. Obviously, like, everyone on this podcast thinks that the types of reforms that Nithya is targeting are very important and we would like to see them passed. But I think that it's important to contextualize that everybody on city council has their issues that are more or less important to them.
Yeah.
That's how this culture came into being and perpetuates itself. Everybody has specific issues that they're trying to get something done on.
Yes.
We had Marquise Harris Dawson on, and he said exactly that to us. He said, I came onto the council hoping to get XYZ done. And in order to do that, I had to give up on a lot of other things. And one of them was police reform. One of them was cutting police budgets.
Yeah. And I do, like, this is unpopular too, but I don't want to cast the other members of the city council as, like, totally without integrity, totally like, careerist and, like, these other things. Like, they have made that calculation a million times because of things. Every single one of them, you're exactly right, Scott, has core issues that are genuinely really important to them, and they're making compromises in a lot of cases to get those things done.
Yeah, I thought a lot about that too after, like, thinking what that would mean to vote something down in someone else's district and, like, the symbolic nature of that. And what I kept thinking was, like, well, isn't the most important thing to evaluate, you know, a council member on is what they're advancing in their own district and their ability to get that voted on and make the case for how important those things are in their district. So I would say, like, point to things like the room key effort. I mean, that will not just be beneficial for CD4 and CD11, but also like very transformative for the entire city. So look at what's being pushed forward, not just vote by vote, you know, institutional failures, I think, that we are going to have to deal with until we double the number of council districts, at least.
I really appreciate Councilmember Rahman's comments on this, and I do think that we're still in uncharted territory. That said, I mean, I think one of the big benefits that she has that is sort of as yet unrealized is the reason why she was able to do this unprecedented thing, get into office in the first place, is because of all of this popular enthusiasm. And that comes with a lot of scrutiny that is not afforded to Curran Price or Bob Blumenfield or Monica Rodriguez. But it's to the same extent that it is an additional pressure on her office, it is also potentially a source of tremendous power. And I think that as much as Councilmember Rahman wants to transform the city council, I personally am not convinced that that can be done with the existing city council. And I know that based on her thread, I know that her approach is that she wants to give people an opportunity to be part of the future of the city council, which is, like I said, that's valid. We're strategically in new territory, but I really have doubts about the likelihood that many of the city council members will take them up on that. So we, I guess, can only really see what happens from here. I remain very hopeful about Nithya's vision for the city, and not just because my wife works for her, but also because that is what we talked about a lot over the course of the past 2 years. Like, I think it is a very quality goal that she has set for Los Angeles. And the only tragedy that I can see is that we don't build enough enthusiasm to actually make this city what we all know that it can be. So I think it is just a matter of maintaining the coalition, and that responsibility falls not just on the people who supported Nithya, but also on the councilwoman herself.
The nice thing about this approach is it kind of can work both ways. And if you see council members like react to a culture change, and like if you see the culture of the city government change in significant ways, if that preserves their power, that's okay. Like if it's part of preserving a healthier environment, that's not a bad thing. But if you allow the enthusiasm to generate and like hold the other council members accountable, and if them not changing with the culture is a threat to their status, then that probably leads to a healthier council down the line too, and like a healthier city. And so I'm much more optimistic today than I was over the last whatever 9-10 days. And yeah, I hope this can kind of carry forward.
Honestly, what I saw after Nithya made her post on social media was a big outpouring of support and people saying, look, we want to hold you accountable. And basically what we want is to see that we have not been excluded from this decision-making process, but that sort of accountability was really well received, I think. And let's talk to somebody else about holding people to account. We have Cerise Castle, formerly of KCRW, now an independent journalist, and let's get to our interview now. Okay, so today we have a very big and exciting guest. Cerise Castle is joining us today, a local reporter formerly of Santa Monica's famous public radio institution, KCRW. She has since gone independent, now is working as a freelancer. During the pandemic, Cerise has had a variety of really eye-catching stories. First, during last summer, you all of our listeners probably remember the story about police breaking quarantine and lockdown rules to have a party in Hollywood. Cerise broke that story with On the Ground reporting and has since turned the underground nightclub scene into something of a beat. And we can definitely talk about that too. But what we really wanted to talk to Cerise about today, this afternoon, as we're recording this, is a media project that she had pitched at KCRW about Black media in LA. We frequently talk about, well, the intersection of being Black, being in these sorts of creative spaces, but also the fact that LA is a media desert and that puts additional pressure on workers of all kinds. Now, KCRW has come out with a My Black LA hashtag. And so we wanted to bring her in to talk about how that came about and how it seems to have been born of an idea that she originally brought to them, which was shut down, and just generally what her experience of being a Black journalist in LA has been like. Cerise, thank you for joining us. We're really glad to have you.
Thank you for that fabulous introduction. Big and exciting journalist. Like, I'm going to write that down and put it on my wall.
Look, I mean, there's not a ton of journalists who have entire social media subgenres dedicated to, if you see this woman, watch out. Like, you're a star. I mean, that's levels that most people don't achieve.
That's clout, yeah.
Thank you.
So we want to start with just some general background. How long were you at KCRW and when did you make the decision to leave the station?
So I was at KCRW for just over a year. I made the decision to leave, God, probably the second before I sent my resignation letter. It was something that I had been thinking about for probably seriously considering once Jennifer Farrow offered buyouts to our entire staff just a few days after we unionized.
Right.
That was when the wheels started turning. My girlfriend had spoken to me many times about how she felt that KCRW was impacting my mental health and well-being. I didn't really take her seriously, to my detriment. It really was interfering with, you know, my happiness. It was bringing back a lot of depression. But at the same time, I felt a lot of responsibility for the other employees of color there that had been counted out, that had been underpaid and overworked. I was very scared that if I left, no one would be there to fight for them. And that's something that, you know, I still have some guilt about, to answer that question.
I really want to talk about this unionization because it is so, just for our listeners, back what feels like a million years ago, but was really only about 6 months ago, there was an announcement by KCRW. There were these 30% operating budget cuts and nearly 30 people left the station, including yourself, Cerise. But I think that one of the things that is, I think, probably hard for people to, or is uncommon for people to even think about, is what it is actually like, if they're not Black, to go through the sorts of microaggressions that you said that you went through on a daily basis. I'm a little bit curious, because you referenced these microaggressions as being part of what led to you feeling like the job was negatively impacting your daily life and your mental health. What was that environment, and why was it creating that pressure, do you feel, on you?
Yeah. So I'll tell you about this happened within my first week at KCRW. I walked up to the door. They have a pole where you use a key fob to tap in and enter and exit the building. Within my first week, I was stopped multiple times by different employees from entering the building, physically prevented me from entering the door.
Wow.
After I had tapped in with my key fob, demanding to see my ID demanding to know where I was going, demanding to know who I was, what my title was, and what I was there to do. I never saw anyone else treated that way. And it happened to me from my first week all the way up until my last week. Wow. That never stopped. I spoke to management about it, and they told me that they would speak to staff. They told me that they would update a guide that they had for interacting with employees, which I don't think something like that should exist. And I told them that if there's generally a security concern, hire a security guard. You shouldn't be asking journalists, audio engineers, editors, photographers to police their workplace. That's disgusting. Right. That's uncalled for. That's not what we're signing up to do. If there's generally a concern, there should be a security guard. You shouldn't be asking people to take on some sort of fascist role to police who and who doesn't belong in the space. That was never adequately addressed. That's just one thing that I experienced. And that was something that I dealt with on a weekly basis. I'm getting like emotional talking about it, but dealing with something like that.
Like you're just showing up at work and
exactly
that like specter of like, are you going to be harassed on your way to do your job? And that this is happening too. I mean, in a broader context during last summer, which was just incredibly trying for every Black American, especially as, you know, we're seeing, just to use one example, stories like the Central Park bird watcher who is like being policed in public space. Like, and there's always the knowledge of how those situations can escalate. That's just an incredible stressor on you personally, I can only imagine.
Yeah. Thinking about last summer, you know, it really makes me think about when I was reporting on the protest for KCRW. You know, one thing that happened was I was shot by LAPD with a rubber bullet. I went on air about 10 minutes after that happened. I'm really proud that I was able to do that. Like, that's definitely like a high point of my career, being able to bring light to this situation. But, you know, one thing that I was really disappointed with was how KCRW handled addressing that with the Los Angeles Police Department. You know, pretty immediately after I was hit, the Los Angeles Board of Supervisors wrote a motion that addressed violence against journalists in LA County. And my situation was actually noted. And that prompted me to follow up with our COO, Paul Benham, COO of KCRW, to ask him, you know, had any complaints been filed because I was injured. I actually ended up not being able to walk for almost 6 months because of what happened to me. And, you know, he told me that he filed a complaint and nothing came of it. Now, that really troubled me because that same weekend, there were many other journalists injured. One that comes to mind is Adolfo Guzman of KPCC. And
yeah.
I believe we actually share an attorney for this particular incident. But, you know, KPCC was really good about coming out and making a statement saying that we don't stand for this. They supported Adolfo when Josie was arrested. This is the same thing. They doubled down and gave her so much support. I'm still fighting KCRW to respond to my emails about where the hell is my complaint? What happened to my complaint? Have you heard anything from the LAPD? Have you heard anything from OIR? They just ignore me. And I feel used. It's like, I can't think of anything that sums it up better than that. You're sending your Black reporter out to report on racial violence. She's shot by a police officer. And you can't take care of her when she's injured, when she can't walk. You can't follow up and make sure that she's good when your sister station is doing like that exact same with the same attorney that y'all work with. It just doesn't make sense to me. It's really horrible.
I was curious too, because that was such a not having the personal insight into what you were going through, the extent of your injuries, that's so horrible. And I really hope that you're doing better now. But I think from the outside though,
there was a pretty obvious disparity in the response between the two stations. And I personally picked up on the Josie Wong incident that you were talking about, where she was attacked brutally and arrested by two deputies of the LA Sheriff's Department. And there was this really strange episode following that where an Associated Press journalist was interviewing Sheriff Villanueva, talking to him about the violence that his office had done to journalists. And he, this whole thing was so strange and sort of vile, but like part of his answer was that it was justified because he misidentified KPCC as having been responsible for your reporting
right.
about this Sassafras Saloon story. And I mean, just to make this even weirder, then on Twitter, Libby Denkman of KPCC points out that that was actually not a KPCC story. That was a story of yours. And Paul Bennin, you just mentioned, the COO at KCRW, put on Twitter this denial that KCRW had published or broadcasted any claims about right. sheriff's deputies being at the Sassafras Saloon, which you Correct. Responded to by tagging the New Union. So I'm just curious, like,
yes.
as somebody seeing that playing out,
it.
Like, what was happening in your mind? Like, when you see that denial, what are you thinking? Like, what is your response?
Typical.
Internally.
Typical. It's honestly, I'm shocked but not surprised.
Yeah.
This is basically, that's just playing out in public everything that I went through behind closed doors. You know, one thing I recall, one incident that really troubles me that happened when I was at KCRW is I had an intern that I was working with. She was in her probably like 19, 20 years old, college student. And we were working in the studio. And on the other side of the glass was the All Things Considered host. His name is Larry Perel. He was unhappy with a call that I made, and he chose to come into the studio that I was in with our intern and proceed to scream at me at the top of his lungs for about 5 minutes in front of my intern, telling me that I was underqualified for my job, that I didn't know what I was doing, that I didn't take my job seriously, that he thought I didn't want to be there. Turned around and left. My intern was in tears. I had to take her out to the bathroom and tell her that this isn't what normally happens here at this station, that that isn't how men should treat you, that that's not how people you work with treat you, that that is unacceptable. And then I had to turn around and go right back and work with him. That happened every day. Something like that happened every day.
It's just horrifying. I mean, can't even imagine being able to navigate on the various levels of having to defend yourself, stick up for yourself, maintain a professional demeanor, and also try and prevent somebody that you're working close with and trying to mentor not to be scared out of an industry that they're passionate about. Like, that's, I don't know how you did it, frankly. Seems like too much for any one person to handle for any length of time.
Yeah, shout out to my therapist for that.
I'm curious though. So you tagged the union. The union is brand new at that point in time. Did you have a role in that unionization effort? And obviously the way that it ended up playing out, you left shortly thereafter because you and everyone else was offered a buyout. But did you have any sort of hope that the union coming in might change those sorts of that's not even a microaggression. That's just straight out aggression. But did you have any hope that the union being there might change conditions, or on an ongoing basis that it is changing conditions for people of color working at the station?
So there's a lot to dig into in that question. Yes, I was involved in the unionization effort. It was one of the reasons that I actually chose to go work for KCRW. Prior to this, I had been at Vice News on HBO. And I'll just say I took a significant pay cut choosing to go into nonprofit radio from television news. But I was really excited about the chance to work at a community DIY station that I had grown up listening to and just be a part of what I thought was a movement toward the kind of workplace that I wanted to be a part of, the kind of workplace where the employees work together collectively to make everything better for everybody. So I got involved in the union. I quickly became, I got a reality check pretty quickly about the union once I got involved with the organizing process. It came to my attention that they had not conducted a pay equity salary that looked at not only gender disparity, but disparity by race. That is, I really don't see how you can talk about equity and inclusion when you're not examining who's in the room and who isn't. So making that discovery, I very quickly lost a lot of the hope and optimism that I had about the union.
It's kind of just like finding out, I would guess it's kind of like finding out that things are much further back in the process than you had thought. Like you're like, okay, we're at this point and we need to push forward.
But then here's
you're
like, the
oh,
thing,
wait, we're
Scott,
actually a mile down the road.
Here's the thing, Scott. They were just weeks away from signing a contract and that conversation hadn't been had, which is a huge red flag. If you're not if you're not talking about this stuff, I don't see how you're weeks away from a contract. That shouldn't be
then
happening.
It's like, okay, this is going to be something that comes up for the next contract, basically, right? Like,
in
it's not even
years.
A conversation. Exactly. Yeah. That is really hard. I'm curious. We talked a little bit at the top about this new debuted hashtag #MyBlackLA that was just announced on Twitter by KCRW. You have a really powerful thread that we'll link to in our show notes that I think all of our listeners should read about the way in which you actually proposed this idea, I think sometime last year, and then it basically went nowhere because of COVID and budget and et cetera, all of the excuses that I think a lot of people might expect when management just doesn't necessarily want to do something. But now that idea has come back around. You were not given credit for it. I'm curious, can you tell us why you approached management with the idea to do something like this, do a project focusing on Black artists, content creators, and how did you come up with that idea and why in the first place?
Yeah, so that was something that when I joined KCRW, that was one of the things that was on the list of things that I wanted to bring to them. You know, I wanted to bring what I had learned about TV news for creating like great viral videos about, you know, newsworthy things. You know, KCRW is very white. Like, we all know this. If you listen to Morning Becomes Eclectic, like, it's in the title right there. Like,
right.
And, you know, Los Angeles County is not a white place. So coming in there, that was something that I saw as a strength. You're hiring me, a really talented multimedia journalist that could, you know, really bring you up to speed with a significant amount of the county that you haven't been servicing for years, since I was a child, at least.
Right.
One of the first emails I got at KCRW was an all-staff email saying, "The air is better in Santa Monica."
What? What does that mean? What?
Oh my God. There's so many layers.
Like the air quality? What does that mean?
Truly, what does it mean?
What does that mean? Yeah.
So I had that idea coming in. I was going through my stuff with the union, seeing that, you know, people really didn't care about race issues there, or so I felt. I was going through my macroaggressions. Racist behavior that I was facing on a daily basis. I also filed a complaint about the racist stuff I was going through with HR. I had several employees join me on that. And I also included, you know, transphobic things that were being said God, what's her name? Frances Anderton sent out a staff-wide email saying that we should have J.K. Rowling on KCRW to talk about her views on why trans people aren't real or whatever. Sonia Geis, the news manager for KCRW, told me and Jerome Campbell that structural racism isn't real in a meeting. So after I filed this complaint, all of this stuff is ongoing, and I was still feeling generous and sort of the mindset that sunlight was the best medicine. So I thought, you know what? You know what'll stamp out all this racism? If we make a show with Black people, get some more Black people in the building, get some more Latinx people in the building. Let's get these people in the building and let's make some content for these people so we can just shake this up and just flush out all these horrible people and their horrible ideas. Let's just replace them
right
with better people. And, you know, the response to that was, that's a really cool idea, Cerise. I really like that, Cerise. I did a lot of extra work that I wasn't compensated for outside of my schedule, setting up meetings with people like Jeff Weiss over at The Land, Javier Cabral over at LA Taco, you know, other people that I've seen out like doing their own thing independently. I set up meetings with them and Paul Benham. And, you know, everyone at KCRW management said, this is a good idea, this is a good idea, this is a good idea. When the date came for this project to get the word on whether or not it would receive funding, all of a sudden it wasn't a great idea anymore. It was, I believe the words he used in the email that I posted was, you know, it would be a challenge to do a homegrown show. Mind you, KCRW produces several homegrown shows. I believe that's actually the model of running a radio station, is producing homegrown shows.
Well, and then they do have shows that they've started more recently. Greater LA, which is a show that, in full disclosure, I am sometimes a guest on, was started, what, like a year and a half ago?
Yes.
There's also shows like Left, Right, and Center that are, you know, have been on the station for decades, it feels like, and that are hosted by people who don't live here, who aren't even really part of the KCRW family or part of the KCRW union.
Right.
I also, for full disclosure, I also pitched this show there in 2016 or something like that. Not anyone who is still there, but that also would have been a homegrown show.
I know that you don't know the answer to this, or at least that you're not part of the discussions that have gone on in the developing of My Black LA, what KCRW is actually proceeding out of this. But basically, my question is, what has changed in the time since you pitched this idea and now? It hasn't been that long. We're still in the pandemic.
There ain't no more Black people at KCRW. That's what's changed. They've got Black ideas and they're making them without any Black people. That's what's changed.
Yeah, because so you left. Jerome left also, right? Tyler Boudreau left. Who is there? There basically is nobody left as far as Black employees or Black content creators.
To my knowledge, they have one person in the news department.
Right.
The news department is about seven people. One person is Black. I believe she's part-time.
Mm-hmm.
They have Novena on Morning Becomes Eclectic, which she co-hosts. And as far as content, there you go.
Right. So I mean that we like I said, we've talked so much about how LA has become and is still becoming this sort of media desert. Media nationally has deeply entrenched problems of racism and in particular anti-Blackness. And it has been very hard for Black journalists to even get a foothold. We had a discussion. There is a question coming, I promise. We had a discussion not that long ago about the LA Times, where they were like patting themselves on the back for having a Black woman journalist, Angel Jennings, covering South LA. Then they promoted her to the masthead because then they could pat themselves on the back for having a Black woman journalist on the masthead. And then they were like, well, now we don't have anybody covering South LA again. And it's just kind of like highlights like
when you're so focused on what could be called these like token achievements for Black journalism, these structural issues just like don't get addressed because you don't really have the resources to do all of the, you can't use the same person to meet all of these needs that exist within the community. I'm just curious, like, how are you finding freelance journalism? Like, is there a place that you've been able to plug in as a Black journalist? Or like, I guess just like, what is your outlook on the state of media and your place in it going forward?
You know what the great thing has been is since I've been getting loud about all the bullshit that I've been put through, I've been actually given a lot more opportunities by people. I've had editors reaching out to me directly to offer me not just freelance stories, but full-time positions, saying that they've read my work, that they love my work, that I'm a talent that they would love to have on their team. So my outlook is, you know, if you're going through something in your workplace, call it the fuck out. I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but
please.
This is what I tell my students. Like, you don't need to put up with this. I feel like so often, like, people tell themselves, especially people of color, we tell ourselves, not just Black people, Latinx people, Asian people, people of all colors, we tell ourselves that we have to fit into the white man's box, right? That we have to put up with this stuff. And what I'm learning is that you really don't. Like, you really don't have to tolerate it. It's bad for your mental health. It's bad for your physical health. You don't have to. If you're going through something, call it out. And, like, if you're afraid to, like, truly you don't need to be at that job. You really don't.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts, too, about the other, like, major reckonings that have been going on just this past week, even in, like, the podcasting world. We had a couple weeks ago, KZRW did drop The Daily from the schedule because of a huge implosion at the New York Times podcast department. And then we had the Reply All situation this week where the host stepped back after doing a series on, you know, racism at another publication, but then were called out for having it as part of their own. I mean, what do you think is the bigger problem, or is there a bigger problem within podcasting and radio journalism?
I think it's like the problem that we see in like all media, right? You're just letting these mediocre white men that have terrible habits, they just fail up. I mean, it's a lot of times they're underqualified, overqualified with bad behavior, and I don't understand why they fail up. I think it just like speaks to the need of like people that are able to call it out, like just please do it. Like, please, if you can, if you feel safe enough to, like, call it out, like, then we can get more of these people canceled and out of the fucking sphere. Sorry for swearing. I'm getting angry.
It's all good.
Very necessary sometimes. But I think, that falls upon you and these other journalists at these other publications, too. They were the ones that had to literally listen to this discussed on a show that they were producing and had to put it out there in the world. I mean, it's just radio is such a personal medium and such a already like so emotional medium that it's very difficult to hear a lot of these stories. And I'm glad that you said something.
Yeah. And also like people need to listen. That's like the other thing. Like I have to say, like, it's kind of unspoken, but like the people in power, like, y'all need to not stop protecting these people. Like, it's not...
Right.
It's not a good business model. Like, beyond, like, it being immoral and just, like, terrible. Like, if nothing else, you're going to lose money. We're going to hit you where it hurts. Like...
Yeah. It's not a good business to be in. Protecting the worst people in media is... And hopefully we can make that as clear as possible.
And I think there's this, like... There's a general thinking that costing someone a position of authority like that is like too cruel a punishment, that it's like this life-ending thing. But like those positions aren't owed. It's not like no one is talking about like prison or anything like that. It's like when authority is mishandled, it's okay to remove it. And that's, I mean, that's to me what we're talking about here. And when you protect communities like that internally, then you're saying no, when authority is mishandled, it should be maintained. And like you're saying, yeah, not a good business model.
Cerise, thank you so much. For our listeners, can you let us know where they can find you online? If there's anything else that you would like to plug for them, stories of yours that, or anything interesting coming up that you want them to be on the lookout for?
Yeah.
What you got?
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Cerise Castle. And yeah, just like follow me on Twitter. That's where all my good stuff is.
Thank you so much, Cerise. You've been a wonderful guest. And I really hope that you get at least some of the justice that is owed to you, because it seems like there's quite a lot.
And a check.
And a check. Justice and a check.
It's Black History Month, damn everybody. It.
That's right. We get one more week. Okay. And then it's back to regular programming. Thank you, everybody, for listening to LA Podcast. We will be back next week. Thank you, Brian Holmes, for producing, as always. And we will talk to you soon. Bye.